Number 78 on my list, the Maranatha Primitive Baptist Church, was a little jewel at the foot of a hill next to a creek under a cluster of pin oaks that were at least 200 years old. It was a small white frame building, narrow and long, with a high-pitched tin roof and a red steeple that was so tall it got lost in the oaks. The front doors were open wide, beckoning any and all to come worship. A cornerstone gave the date as 1813. I eased into the back pew, my usual place, and sat next to a well-dressed gentleman who had been around for as long as the church. I counted 56 other worshipers that morning. The windows were wide open, and outside a gentle breeze rushed through the trees and soothed the rough edges of a hectic morning. For a century and a half, people had gathered there, sat on the same pews, looked through the same windows at the same trees, and worshipped the same God. The choir, all eight, sang a gentle hymn, and I drifted back to another century. The pastor was a jovial man named J.B. Cooper. I'd met him twice over the years while scrambling around trying to put together obituaries. One side benefit to my tour of county churches was the introduction to all the ministers. This really helped spice up my obits. Pastor Cooper gazed upon his flock and realized I was the only visitor. He called my name, welcomed me, and made some harmless crack about getting favorable coverage in the Times. After 4 years of touring and 77 rather generous and colorful church notes, it was impossible for me to sneak into a service without getting noticed. I never knew what to expect in these rural churches. More often than not, the sermons were loud and long, and many times I wondered how such good people could drag themselves in week after week for a tongue-lashing. Some preachers were almost sadistic in their condemnation of whatever their followers might have done that week. Everything was a sin in rural Mississippi, and not just the basics as set forth in the Ten Commandments. I heard scathing rebukes of television, movies, card playing, popular magazines, sports events, cheerleader uniforms, desegregation, mixed-race churches, Disney, because it came on Sunday nights, dancing, social drinking, postmarital sex, everything. But Pastor Cooper was at peace. His sermon, 28 minutes, was about tolerance and love. Love was Christ's principal message. The one thing Christ wanted us to do was to love one another. For the altar call, we sang three verses of Just As I Am, but no one moved. These folks had been down the aisle many times. As always, I hung around afterward for a few minutes to speak with Pastor Cooper. I told him how much I enjoyed the service, something I did whether I meant it or not, and I collected the names of the choir members for my column. Church folk were naturally warm and friendly, but at this stage of my tour, they wanted to chat forever and pass along little gems that might end up in print. My grandfather put the roof on this building in 1902. The tornado of 38 skipped right over us during the summer revival. As I was leaving the building, I saw a man in a wheelchair being pushed down the handicap ramp. It was a face I'd seen before, and I walked over to say hello. Lenny Farguson, the crippled boy, juror number 7 or 8, had evidently taken a turn for the worse. During the trial in 1970, he had been able to walk, though it was not a pretty thing to behold. Now he was in a chair. His father introduced himself. His mother was in a cluster of ladies finishing up one last round of goodbyes. "Got a minute?" Farguson asked. In Mississippi, that question really meant, "We need to talk and it might take a while." I sat on a bench under one of the oaks. His father rolled him over, then left us to talk. "I see your paper every week," he said. "You think Padgett will get out?" "Sure, it's just a question of when. He can apply for parole once a year, every year." "Will he come back here, to Ford County?" I shrugged because I had no idea. "Probably. The Padgetts stick close to their land." He considered this for some time. He was gaunt and hunched over like an old man. If my memory was correct, he was about 25 at the time of the trial. We were roughly about the same age, though he looked twice as old. I had heard the story of his affliction, some injury in a sawmill. Does that frighten you? I asked. He smiled and said, Nothing frightens me, Mr. Trainer. The Lord is my shepherd. Yes, he is, I said, still warm from the sermon. Because of his physical condition and his wheelchair, Lenny was a difficult person to read. He had endured so much. His faith was strong, but I thought for a second that I caught a hint of apprehension. Mrs. Ferguson was walking toward us. Will you be there when he's released? Lenny asked. I'd like to be, but I'm not sure how it's done. Will you call me when you know he's out? Of course. Mrs. Ferguson had a pot roast in the oven for Sunday lunch, and she wouldn't take no for an answer. I was suddenly hungry, and there was, as usual, nothing remotely tasty in the Hocut house. Sunday lunch was typically a cold sandwich and a glass of wine on a side porch, followed by a long siesta. Lenny lived with his parents on a gravel road 2 miles from the church. His father was a rural mail carrier, his mother a schoolteacher. An older sister was in Tupelo. Over roast and potatoes and tea almost as sweet as Miss Callie's, we relived the Castlelaw trial and Paget's first parole hearing. Lenny may have been unconcerned about Danny's possible release, but his parents were deeply worried.